It's April Fool's Day. We're recording this on April Fool's Day. And it comes out the day before you come to see us.
Okay.
It all feels really good.
So is this a whole joke?
No, there are very few jokes in this. This is harrowing.
Are you going to say at the end, April Fool's?
Yeah. This never happened. Rather than doing some research this week, I just sat and wrote a fantastical tale.
I was going to say, this could be like the teaser of your book.
What, fantastical tales and why they're not historically accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I do have to say, I did have to debunk some stuff in this one. There was debunking, yeah. Well,
amazing.
The primary source that I used for this was a newspaper article.
Okay.
And it turns out the people who wrote the newspaper article were taking some liberties with timelines and sort of events that happened.
To fit an agenda.
To make it into a more sort of sensationalist story. It's still a pretty damn good story, but they tried to shoehorn in some other things that they thought would add.
I mean, I know you've not started, but depending on the year of said event, that I can imagine people's job description at the newspaper would have been to grab people's attention and be a bit more salacious.
Hey up, I'm Joe Heathcote, and this is Consistently Eccentric, a British history podcast where we try to make sense of some of the lesser known and more absurd people and events these islands have produced. So let's get started with...
This story starts in the city of Ville-Marie in New France in the year 1648.
What is New France?
That would be where Canada sits today.
Okay.
And in fact, Ville-Marie is the modern-day city of Montreal. Because, you know, that's the reason that quite a large area of Canada is still French-speaking, is because originally
like
it was French
Dion.
Territory. Yes, that well-known territory of Canada, Celine Dion.
No, I meant she is a French speaker.
Oh, is she?
Yeah. Cool.
What, as a primary language?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. I did not know that.
No, I didn't know that. I might be making it up, but I know she's French-Canadian.
And probably dual-lingual.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Ville-Marie had been founded by some very, very devout Catholics in 1642, who wanted to try and convert the indigenous people to all the glory of Catholicism.
Uh-huh.
You know, the way they do when they go over there. You're doing it wrong. You're doing morality wrong. Come over here and feel bad about yourself.
Yeah. Shame.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're bringing to the table here. We don't feel you have enough shame in your current cultural makeup, so we're going to...
We're going to make you feel bad about everything.
Oh, every time you had fun? No, that was shameful. Naturally, considering they were trying to destroy the local culture, they needed quite a bit of protection. And the city also became the site of a French military garrison. Now, given that this was a place populated almost exclusively at the time by priests and soldiers, it's somewhat surprising that the first recorded incident of homosexuality didn't occur for 6 years.
They were definitely at it. It's just it wasn't recorded.
Yeah, the first court.
Yeah.
In 1648, an unnamed military drummer was accused of sodomy.
Little drummer boy. Mm.
It was likely with one of the locals that the priest was so keen on converting, because there's no records of the other person involved in the sodomy. And due to the way that things were set up at the time, they didn't have legal jurisdiction over the indigenous peoples. So they reckon that this military drummer went off and found himself a lovely local Canadian, indigenous Canadian, and they had a lovely relationship. But when it was found out, they were like, well, we can't do anything to him, but you, laddie, come on, prison.
Shameful.
He was tried, and he was eventually found guilty of committing crimes of the worst kind, which was their euphemism.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for the drummer, this was a point in history and a place in the world where practicing homosexuality was still a crime punishable by death.
Oh, really? What year are we in, sorry?
1648.
Oh, yeah, it would be.
But while the priests were happy to sentence a man to death for expressing himself, it turned out that they were all a bit squeamish when it came to actually carrying out the execution. In fact, they had such trouble finding someone to do the deed that they became concerned that it could start to cause a bit of an issue with law and order in New France. After all, if the citizens knew that they could not be executed, they might start engaging in homosexuality all over the place.
And it would be a pandemic.
It would. But, you know, that idea of, well, we've sentenced him to death, he has to die, but no one's willing to kill him.
Mm. Yeah.
This could... We can't sort of row back on it, can we? You know, we made
They might have to.
Crimes of the worst kind. We can't just... We were quite absolute about things here.
Yeah.
The eventual solution they came up with was to offer the drummer a chance to have his death sentence commuted, just so long as he promised to become the official executioner and to try and stop thinking about men in tight clothes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But you've basically given him the go-ahead to wear, like, a leather outfit with, like, an axe. This is definitely, like, Berlin rave scene vibes.
It's immediately like, oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
I've even got my own outfit. We didn't ask you to get an outfit. It's lovely, look.
It's very fitting.
Yeah, it shows off all my muscles. I need to look intimidating. Now, the drummer agreed to the terms, and he was almost immediately put to work. He was faced with the harrowing task of dispatching his first criminal, a 15-year-old girl who had been convicted of theft. That's all. Because there were so many things that were punishable by death back in the day. So he'd been done for the sex he was having, and this young girl...
I'm assuming she was hungry.
Mm. Well, we talked about it when we were doing the Halifax gibbet, didn't we?
How do you remember these things?
They don't really get remembered properly. They kind of just are all in a soup in my mind, and sometimes I can make the connection, sometimes I can't. But you know when we were talking about the guys who'd stolen, like... just some ribbon. It's like, oh, well, death. I have a feeling that this 15-year-old girl, it was probably similar. Just so. You've done practically nothing wrong, but hey, it's easier for us to just kill you.
Is it, though? I don't think killing someone is, like, an easy thing to do.
Well, I guess killing someone is a one-off cost to pay the executioner.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Whereas if you sentence them to a long prison sentence...
Then you have to pay for it, yeah.
Yeah, it is more cost-effective to just kill them and be done with it than to say, right, well, we're sentencing you to 10 years. And unfortunately for the people of Canada, I guess, you know, you couldn't say, right, we're going to transport you.
Because to where?
Yeah.
Where now? There's nowhere left.
Well, yeah, this would have been before Australia as well, so there was nothing.
Nothing.
The first official executioner, our little drummer boy, he lasted around 5 years before disappearing from history altogether. Hopefully to somewhere more tolerant of his lifestyle choices.
With that man?
Yeah, hopefully, you know, after 5 years he just went, look, have I done enough? I really want to go off into the wilds with this local tribe.
This chap, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's going to be there as well, but I promise I won't think about him in that way anymore. At least until we're outside of your jurisdiction.
And then, boom.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's back. But while he was gone, the process of picking new executioners stuck around, with criminals sentenced to death being offered the post if it happened to be vacant at the time when their execution was due to take place. And this was the way that Canadian executioners were picked for the next 100 or so years.
Really?
So it was really like a lottery. If you were lucky enough that the last executioner left... just at the time when you were going through the sort of processing, you might be the one that they selected to go, right, we're going
to
offer
you this
deal.
I'm not sure that's... Like, I don't think I would want to... I'd choose death, I think.
Mm. Oh, I'd always choose life. I mean,
even
obviously
if you had to kill loads of people.
Yeah.
Who... Like, we flip reverse, man.
Mm.
But the thing is, I would always get people to do it for me. I think that's the... I'd be like, there's no blood on my hands. I didn't do nothing.
Well, I mean,
I just told them to do it.
If you're hanging someone, you've got assistance. I guess you could sort of middle manage that.
Yeah.
Be like, no, I have to stand back and just orchestrate the things. I'm never actually going to pull the lever.
Yeah.
Mm. But I say for over 100 years, we know, because in 1751, another military drummer called Jean Corlier also found himself in hot water.
For the same crime?
Well, it did involve him getting hot and bothered with another man, but in his case, he was sentenced to death for engaging in an illegal duel.
Oh.
So the duel hadn't ended with either of them dying. It had been broken up before the pistols had been fired. And the other guy had apparently managed to make good his escape while they were busy arresting Jean. Wow. So, yeah.
I like it how there's illegal duels and non-illegal duels.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I think it was just, it was legal and then it wasn't. I don't think there was like a, had to fill in the right paperwork. I think at just some point they went, do you know what? There's too many people challenging each other.
And like killing each other.
You can't walk into a pub without being slapped in the face by a glove. So we're just going to...
We shall duel. Yeah.
You've done it too much. You've ruined it for yourselves, guys. Just a ban.
Such egotistical, maniac, testosterone fueled nonsense.
Yeah, and you know it's young guys who don't ever actually contemplate the fact that they could die.
Yeah.
They're doing it for the lols.
Yeah. Banter, innit?
Mm. And now, although he was sentenced in the January of 1751, by August, Jean was still sitting in prison for lack of an executioner.
Okay.
And during this long wait, he discovered that his cell was next to that of Francois Laurent, a young servant girl who was also awaiting execution for stealing clothes from her employers. Over the course of the months, the two got to talking, because what else are you going to do when you're sharing cells next to each other?
Yeah.
And they appear to have fallen in love.
Mm.
I mean, it's not the best start to a romance.
I mean, there's been worse.
Yeah, I mean, any day they could have gone, guess what? We found someone to take the job.
Damn.
Next week, we'll finally get round to it. I'm sure you're relieved. But the fact that, you know, the romance could only last as long as there was no executioner, it may seem a bit odd that on August 17th of 1751, Jean agreed to take on the role of executioner in order to save his own life.
So he had to kill this woman that he fell in love with?
Hmm. Well, he had a plan. Because while male prisoners could agree to become the executioner to avoid their sentence, there was also a workaround for female prisoners. They had a way to escape the noose. It was as long as they agreed to marry the executioner.
Ah!
Because they found that married executioners were happier executioners.
Yeah, yeah.
Were able to last longer before the crushing weight of their duties, you know, took a psychological toll on them.
Yeah.
Francois accepted Jean's marriage proposal the very next day. So he was made, executioner on the 17th. He was married on the 18th.
Brilliant.
And the young couple were able to start afresh a year later, after Jean had completed enough executions to buy his freedom.
Brilliant.
So there you go. That's how you start a romance.
Yeah.
You know how you were saying, you know, I've got to go and find people.
Yeah.
Have you ever considered prison? To meet like-minded people.
I'm not sure. Maybe I'd do quite well.
It's always an option.
It's always an option, yeah.
It's like the final option. But
why did you come to prison? I wanted to find a partner.
Yeah, I wanted to meet interesting people, and I felt this was the place.
Yeah.
And they can't run away from me here, literally.
Love me!
Oh, you'd be a terror.
I would be. I'd be running down the corridors. They'd be like, that Englishman, get him away from me. But I love you.
Oh, and that's how you ended up in solitary. I love too much. It's my only crime. That and the person you killed. Yes.
Yeah, that too. It was just...
Mainly it's the love. While Canada was officially ceded by France to Britain in February of 1763... the first British execution in Canada actually took place in 1749, when a sailor called Peter Cartzell entered into a disagreement with a man called Abraham Goodsides.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a good name though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sadly for Abraham though, his Goodsides were not good enough to deflect the knife, and he was stabbed to death by Cartzell.
Oh no. Over what, do we know?
I'm guessing something incredibly minor.
Yeah.
But you know how it gets when you're trapped in a small confine with people for an extended period of time. Those little annoyances suddenly become
big annoyances.
Yeah, they're magnified just over and over until eventually you could stab your mate Goodsides over his snoring, took that bit of meat that you wanted.
He looked at me funny.
Even looked at him funny. Could be anything. As this happened on a British ship that was docked in Halifax Harbour, Peter was tried before a captain's court, where he was sentenced to death. 2 days later, he was hung from the yardarm of the ship as a warning to everybody else to not murder.
Don't dick about,
don't
guys.
Murder.
Yeah.
A little bit of light stabbing, that's okay, but don't take it too far.
Yeah.
Everybody likes a joke.
You've just ruined it for everyone. Mm.
When Canada became a confederation in 1867, the role of executioner was still quite an ad hoc affair. That was until, in 1892, the justice minister at the time, Sir John Thompson, decided to appoint a professional in order to ensure equal access to justice for all. Because the problem with it being an ad hoc affair were the sheriffs could pretty much hire anyone, was that the quality of executioner that you might get, I mean, they were still sort of shanghaiing people into doing it to commute their own sentences here and there, so you might get somebody who is really well-versed in executing people and is really professional, or you might get a guy who yesterday was awaiting a death sentence himself and was still learning how to tie knots.
So there's no standard.
There's no standard at this point. And they were like, do you know what? We need standards.
There's no training manual.
No, no. It was generally you would assist another executioner for a while, and then you'd either set up on your own or the person you were assisting would die and you'd take their place. So it was an apprenticeship scheme rather than something that you'd go
with. I bet you were well hated as an executioner.
Oh, we'll get into it. But yes, I mean, back in the day, especially in sort of Germany, some of those Central European countries, it was that weird. They were treated really well, but were also sort of kept at arm's length from society. So they were paid well, but they wouldn't be allowed to go into the taverns. You know, and people wouldn't want to spend too much time associating with them.
Mm.
So it had a prestige, but also it set you apart.
Yeah, because
from
they
society.
might end up hanging you one day.
Yeah, which is awkward.
Yeah, and I think it's my mate John from the pub.
We did cover that, didn't we? Where
yeah,
one of
we
them
did, yeah.
Killed his neighbour or somebody he knew, and it was like really awkward. But I guess that's where your professionalism really gets tested, isn't it?
Yeah.
The man that was selected for the role, the first official chief executioner of Canada, was called John Radcliffe. Not Radcliffe. I did double check this.
Radcliffe?
Yeah, John Radcliffe.
Do you reckon it's a like precursor to the name?
I think it
Radcliffe.
Might be a variation, yeah. Like someone misheard it, put it on a form and that was
or
that.
Or misspelt it, yeah.
Yeah. But he's Radcliffe anyway.
Okay.
Who claimed that he had learned the trade from the famous British executioner, William Marwood.
He said, well, now that you said claims, I think he's lying.
Well, William Marwood is famous for being the innovator of the long drop method, so he's quite important in the history of executions.
Yeah.
Now, there are no records to suggest that John did actually train under Marwood, so he's never listed as being, like, his assistant in any things. And if he did, if we give him the benefit of doubt and say he did train under Marwood, he didn't seem to take the lessons to heart because he did not seem keen to use the long drop method like his supposed mentor.
Was he in favour of the short drop?
Oh, no.
Axe?
No, he was still hanging people. He had a very unique way of doing it. He developed his own method of hanging, by which the condemned man was jerked into the air rather than dropped. It was described during the execution of a man called Robert Neal at Toronto's Don Jail on February 29th, 1888.
Thus, I'm trying to get my head around how you jerk someone in the air.
I'll give you the description, see if that helps.
Yeah.
The old plan of a drop was discarded for a more merciful machine, by which the prisoner is jerked up from a platform on the ground level by a weight of 280 pounds, which is suspended by an independent rope pending the execution. At the words, "Forgive us our trespasses," the executioner drove his chisel against the light rope that held the ponderous iron in the other end of the noose. And in an instant, the heavy weight fell with a thud, and the pinion body was jerked into the air and hung dangling between the rough posts of the scaffold.
Okay, right, so he's initially on the ground.
Yep.
And then he's attached to this contraption that's got heavy weights.
Yeah.
Then he gets pulled up, basically, when that weights go down. Okay, so would that kill him instantly?
Probably not, because although there's an initial jerk,
it's
probably not going to be enough. Plus, he always used this 280-pound weight, so he wasn't sort of like calculating what would be needed.
Weighing it per person.
Yeah, he didn't have a set of weights that he would attach based on the size of the person. It's thought that Radcliffe had actually learned to execute people during his time in the Navy, and his method was as close as he could get to hoisting people up on the yardarm while still being on dry land.
Okay.
So on the boats, they would hoist you up rather than drop you, because trying to get someone to walk along a yardarm and allow themselves to be attached to a noose was probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So you had to do it on deck and hoist them. And it seems like this guy, this is what he knew.
Brutal.
Mm. It was.
Yeah.
Either way, the new method didn't catch on and was last recorded as being used in 1890, which meant that he was using it for a good 2-3 years.
Yeah.
You know, there was just this weird moment in time in Canada where you didn't have a short drop.
You just were jerked up.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to get jerked tomorrow, boy.
And that's what got him into this mess in the first place.
Nearly 20 years as the official hangman of Canada took its toll on John, with some papers reporting that he executed over 150 people during that period. He began drinking heavily to cope, and this took a toll on his health.
As you would.
In fact, he died at the age of only 55 in 1911 of an alcohol-related disease.
You're not surprised?
No. I mean, 20 years is a long time to be. That's what you do.
Killing all the people.
Well, not all the people, hopefully. I mean, he didn't go...
You did.
I'm going to jerk all of you. But it left the Canadians without an official hangman yet again.
It's puzzling me, because Canada has always seemed as like quite a nice, friendly nation.
Yeah, maybe that's why they had difficulty finding executioners.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, not me. I mean, I know that you need to do your justice thing, but it's just not for me.
Yeah.
Can't we just rehabilitate him, maybe?
Or maybe the Canadians just seem so nice because America can seem so brutal sometimes.
That's just by association. Americans. They're so close. It's like, well, we're bound to make the comparison and you're going to come off favourably.
Yeah.
Luckily for the Canadians this time, though, there was a man who was actually ready and willing to take on the job. Out of choice.
Oh.
Arthur Bartholomew English.
That's a very English name.
Well, he was English. Yeah. He was born in Newcastle-upon-Tyne on March the 11th, 1865.
Wonderful.
He was the son of a British Army officer and a well-connected country gentleman. So his dad knew the right people. You know, I imagine he went straight into the officer class.
What an odd thing you wouldn't put like a posh country gentleman and executioner together, would you? I would see executioner as like a lower ranking job.
Mm. And a lot of people did. But you're assuming that Arthur Bartholomew English, executioner, was his first choice.
Oh.
Because as soon as he was old enough, he decided to join the army on the officer track with the Northumberland Fusiliers to follow in the footsteps of his dad. Okay. So his first choice was, I'm going to go into the army.
Yeah.
And he did well. During his career, he served in India, in Egypt under Lord Kitchener, and in South Africa during the Boer War. At one point as well, he managed to win the Army Lightweight Boxing Championship.
Okay.
So he was all in on the army. He was having a successful career. He was climbing the greasy pole.
Lads, lads, lads.
Yeah, enjoying it. A bit of boxing.
Yep.
He had been married at some point, but by the time he was ready to retire from the army after 30 years of brave service, he was divorced.
Oh.
And he was childless.
Oh.
Meaning that he was probably going to need to find himself a hobby in order to occupy his time.
And his hobby was killing people.
Not at first. Not at first, to be fair to him. It was just he was interested in the methodology of it. He was a scholar rather than an active practitioner.
Yeah.
He'd received an inheritance from his father that was enough that he could have, you know, settled into that stereotypical life of a moneyed country gentleman.
Yeah.
It could have gone hunting, shooting, fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at some point, he developed a fascination with executions. And now that he had time on his hands, he began attending as many as he could. Although the last public executions had taken place in 1868, it was still possible to attend the hangings in the prison yards if you were well-connected enough to get an invite, or if you were a member of the press. They were still allowed to watch in order that they could report on the sentence being carried out successfully.
Right.
So you could either be invited by, say, the prison warder as a guest, or you could just, you know, say that you're writing for a particular newspaper. And like you say, there were so many newspapers around, you could probably just make one up.
I mean, it seems so alien to us now, doesn't it? But I reckon loads of people would have gone to public executions. A lot of people who
tens
say...
Tens of thousands at times.
Yeah, but a lot of people now said, I would never have done that. Yeah, but it's the context of the time that you're in as well. Like, we don't live in that period of time, so we find it really bizarre.
Mm.
But I guarantee if they started doing them tomorrow, people would go.
Oh, yeah. Well, people do. I mean, in America, you still need witnesses for executions, and people mm-hmm. are on waiting lists to do those kinds of things. You just sit there in the little with the glass screen so you can watch through.
Yeah, that's mad.
At the time that he started watching executions, the chief executioner in England was a bloke called John Ellis. Good Lancashire man.
Yep.
Now, the newspaper report that I used as one of the main sources for this episode states that Arthur's decision to become an executioner himself came as a result of witnessing the execution of a woman called Edith Jessie Thompson, who had been convicted of aiding her young lover in the murder of her husband, Percy.
On the day... Hold on, this sounds familiar.
Well, I'll give you the story. Maybe you've heard the story before.
Okay.
On the day of the execution, Edith had collapsed at the thought of what was about to happen to her, and she was administered so much morphine by the doctors that she was practically unconscious when Ellis entered the condemned cell to complete his task. It was reported that she was placed in a chair to be taken to the gallows. However, she was actually carried bodily by one of the assistants, who had to jump back at the last second as Edith was unable to support her own weight on the trapdoor. So they basically hung an unconscious woman.
Nice.
It was massively controversial at the time, because it was a particularly horrific execution.
Uh-huh.
And people do suggest that it may have contributed to John Ellis committing suicide a couple of years later. Because he felt particularly bad about this one, because the question of her innocence in the affair was still up in the air.
Right.
A lot of people felt she was innocent, and that the only reason that she was being executed was because of the adultery.
Yeah, probably.
And that sort of, we've got to punish... We've got to show women that they can't leave their husbands.
They can't leave their men, yeah.
But while it was horrific and while it was controversial, we can definitely state that Arthur English did not witness it, as it occurred in 1923. And by this time, Arthur had already been living in Canada for over a decade.
Oh.
It's also the reason I can say with confidence that he did not, as the article also claims, fight in World War I.
Liars.
So it's a bit of a sensationalist article that was the primary source for this. So bear that in mind as we're going through. I tried to fact check as many bits as I could.
Oh, good but for being honest.
There may be some bits that are...
Fabricated
or, it's dialed up to 11 for dramatic intent.
Which is fine.
The reason that Arthur moved to Canada is that he had answered an advertisement for a new head executioner, as Canada had been struggling to find the right man for the job for over a year by that point. In order to boost his credentials, having not actually executed anyone to this point that we know of, Arthur gave his last name as Ellis, potentially to suggest some kind of familial connection to John Ellis.
Did it work?
Well, he arrived in Montreal in 1912 at the age of 48, ready to begin a second career as a hangman. So it did work, yeah. They went, oh, yes. You mean like John Ellis? Yes, yes, I'm aware of him. So he's like, family? Well, if you go back far enough, probably.
Yeah.
I've definitely seen him execute many a person. And you assisted, didn't you? Well, I watched keenly, yes. The great man at work.
Done.
Not that he told anyone that this was what he had emigrated for.
I was going to say, I can't imagine that would go down well in the posh circles.
As far as his new neighbours in Montreal were concerned, he was a retired British Army officer who would occasionally travel to help with some unspecified government business, and who seemed mainly occupied in tending his rather impressive flower garden.
Okay. Is that a euphemism?
No, he had a really nice flower garden, apparently.
Oh,
you know, he had a little house in a nice suburban district of Montreal, and he had the full-on, you know, like the picket fence, the nice little garden. He kept the lawn nice. He was very sort of well-liked amongst his neighbours. He had lots of war stories. You know, he was convivial. He'd invite people round. But he wouldn't tell anyone what he actually did.
Okay.
Like I say, he was well-liked. And this soon attracted the attention of a local woman called Edith Grimsdale. The pair married in 1916. And even after he'd married the woman, Arthur refused to tell her what he did on his trips away from the home.
I mean, that's good going, isn't it? Like, I mean, keeping that.
Yeah, you can leave the mystique. You can be like, I need to go on government business. And you can never ask me what that is. And leave it for her to fill in the blanks.
I suppose if you've said that from day dot...
Mm. Yeah, then... you're not lying to her.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lie of omission, but you've sort of set your stall out. You haven't suddenly, after you got married...
Changed it.
Now, you may come into my home, but you may never go through that door. Oh, God, I've made a mistake.
But I want to.
I've never wanted anything more now that you've said that.
As soon as someone tells me I can't do something, that's instantly what I want to do.
Yeah, but you're quite contrarian, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, Arthur had chosen to live in Montreal in order to be near to Bordeaux Jail, which was where the largest number of executions took place within Canada. However, the job of hangman in Canada was essentially still a freelance affair. So although he was the chief hangman in Canada, he was still doing it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. And he was getting paid per
execution.
Execution, so it wasn't salaried.
Yeah, he was... Eventually it became salaried. He argued for it to become salaried.
I was going to say, that'd be quite good if it was salaried, because maybe you wouldn't have to do it... Maybe there wasn't any executions for a month or two.
Mm. Yeah.
And he's still getting paid.
It protects you against that. Well, when he started, at least, it was a freelance affair. You know, he would be hired by different sheriffs across the country as and when was needed. But along with his fee, they also paid travel expenses, which is nice.
Yeah.
Mm. This fee, it seemed to reflect how hard it was to find a hangman in Canada when compared to the UK, with Arthur receiving around $200 Canadian per execution, which would be the equivalent to around £3,671 today.
Oh, nice.
I've converted it to UK to make sense.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, per body, that's not bad.
No,
If you did a couple in a day... Jesus, yeah. But if you were doing, like, even one execution a month, you'd still be living comfortably in today's
The amount of flowers that you could buy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if he only bought annuals and had to sort of restock each year. If he was just buying sort of bed implants, or if he had some that would be coming back and back and back. Anyway, this amount of £3,671 was approximately 8.5 times higher than what John Ellis received per execution in the UK.
So he was doing better than the chiefdom.
In the UK, you'd be getting around £433 per execution.
Okay.
Now, looking at it in that way doesn't seem enough for what you're being asked to do.
No.
I think I would be asking more than that.
Yeah, but I suppose if they've got nothing to compare it to until now.
Yeah, but I'd be keeping an eye because the hangmen and executioners.
I want the
national
living wage.
Yeah, well, in the USA, it fell somewhere in between the two as the average sort of cost. In England, it was a really low paid profession, all things considered, which is why a lot of the hangmen that we talk about in the UK had second jobs or would like run a pub or would do something else.
I can imagine it would be seen as quite a low down job.
And this was after Marwood, you know,
made
it. It's
a dirty job, isn't it? Like a gruesome,
was.
Dirty job.
I mean, when you think way back, you know, like the executioners who execute people by sword, they had to be really skilled because you sort of, the person would be stood up and you'd swing it, and then you get one shot.
Didn't Henry VIII order...
A special executioner?
But he'd done it before the trial, so he'd sent for this executioner.
I did not know it was before the trial.
Yeah, I think he sent this French... got this French executioner on their way before Anne Boleyn was seen as guilty.
You're going to give me a fair trial? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
ASAP. Just going to send that letter off. Yeah. Who's that to, my lord? Never you mind, Anne. It's fine. It's fine.
Anne Boleyn's brother was meant to be hot.
Right.
George Boleyn. He was meant to be fit.
Executed as well.
Yeah, yeah. He was executed first. Yeah. But he was meant to be fit.
Well, that's the problem with being sexy in the Tudor era. You're more likely to get involved in these nefarious machinations, and I'm quite happy. Quite happy being an uggo at court who just, you know, tries to be funny.
An uggo.
Yeah. No one's involving me in their plots and schemes. I'm just there for the pies and the lols.
But do they have buns of steel?
Well, actually, the meat pies, I imagine the meat pies that were served to Henry VIII would have been some banging meat pies. I feel like he was a connoisseur of the meat pie.
Marks and Spencer's quality meat pie.
That's why I'm going to court. I don't want to try and overthrow anyone or, you know, grab power. I just want to grab those pies.
I'd be the person that was trying to overthrow.
Yeah, yeah. And that's fine, because if you win, I'm, by association, going to get power anyway. I don't need to dirty my hands in the actual mechanics.
What would you like to be lord of?
Didn't we do this?
We probably did.
I said Lord Douglas, because then I can take Douglas in.
Did do this. See, I'm repeating myself.
I don't have to go very far. The significantly higher fee may have influenced Arthur in his decision not to engage in the traditional practice of selling bits of the rope or some of the condemned prisoner's effects as grisly souvenirs.
So would they do that to get extra income?
Yeah, the term money for old rope comes from when the hangman would sell sections of the rope they'd use to hang somebody to the crowd. But Arthur wouldn't engage in any of those practices because he was like, well, I'm getting paid well anyway.
I'm highbrow.
Yeah, and I'm trying to make this a somber and dignified affair. I'm trying to show that there's professionalism in this. I'm taking this on as a professional job, not as, something just to do.
If we're going to do it, we do it properly.
Yeah. It's not just morbid curiosity. I feel like I'm a professional in this. He was described by the Toronto Star as a dapper-looking Englishman, and he considered himself to be scientific in his calculations to ensure the perfect long drop for each of his victims.
Okay.
He even reportedly had his own portable gallows built in order to ensure that there was no room for error. These gallows were painted blood red for some reason.
Was it so he didn't notice the stainage?
Well, I don't know if it was just... It might have just been red wood, and it looked like it was painted red, but he had these blood-red gallows that would be packed up, and if he had to go to some of the smaller prisons that may not have their own gallows, it's like, rather than have some handymen knock up an ad hoc kind of construction...
He had his professional...
So he knew it was going to work, he knew how to set it up. You know, the one at Bordeaux prison, he used the one that was there all the time because it was the main place where people were executed, but when he had to go out into, the provinces...
He needed his own... Yeah.
Which is a terrifying idea, this well-dressed little Englishman just turning up and you're looking out the condemned cell into the yard and you can see this blood-red gallows being erected.
I bet he killed animals as a child.
There's nothing... I mean, I don't know anything about his childhood. All I know is he joined the army at some point. So, maybe.
No.
You think this was his way of getting out of his system?
Yeah.
Like, it was either this or he would have...
Even to join the army, you've got to be a bit brutal, because obviously your whole job is potentially you're going to kill loads of people.
Yeah, I guess he spent his life from the age of 16 knowing that it's likely that he's going to kill someone with regularity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's probably made peace with that. It seems like he compartmentalised things.
That's why I could never be in the army. Like, I'd shoot one person and then be mortified for the rest of my life.
Aww. Yeah, I don't think they like that in the army.
No.
Well, it was a crack shot, but then he spent the next half an hour weeping crying and apologising.
I'm sorry.
Just cradling this poor man.
I might really like it.
I guess you only know when you know.
Yeah,
it's not something you can really prepare for until you're there and doing it. Like, oh, God.
I suppose if you're in a situation, it's either they die or you die.
Mm. I guess that's the only justification you can use, isn't it? It's like, well, in that moment, someone was dying.
I bet you get a bit of a high out of it.
I think it's probably more the surviving in those situations.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the whole, scenario. And this is when we knew Ollie was going to be a murderer.
Aw, if you are, I'll be one of those talking heads who goes, I didn't see it coming.
And they'd play this nice. Clip.
Yeah. You did.
You were complicit.
Why didn't you warn the police? On the day of an execution, Arthur would dress in his best suit and would enter the cell and complete the pinioning of the prisoner within seconds. He would then escort them to the gallows and affix the hood and noose and would wait for the chaplain to finish his prayers before clicking his heels and releasing the trapdoor.
I've just got this vision of, you know, there's no place like home.
Yeah.
The ruby red slippers.
I mean, I don't know. He had a ruby red gallows, so maybe he twinned that with ruby red sort of slippers.
A suit. Yeah. Like these shiny, bright red shoes.
Click, click. Thunk. Yeah. He reportedly stated that on the day of an execution, he had only one focus. My fear is that sometime I may make a mistake and inflict unnecessary torture on the prisoner. So he's all business, this man.
Mm-hmm.
He's at least outwardly saying, I'm not a sadist. I'm not into...
I just want to get it done. Yeah. Yeah.
This person's sentenced to death. They're not sentenced to pain. They're not sentenced to torture. So let's try and do one without the other.
Yeah.
This extended to Arthur insisting that each execution was conducted in a somber and dignified manner.
Okay.
With no more people in attendance than was absolutely necessary. And he took great pains. I mean... He was living a double life anyway, but to make sure that no one got any photos of him, that he was able to enter and exit the prison without anyone finding out. You know, he kept everything as secretive as possible.
Yeah.
Out of respect for the person that he was
so
killing.
So his neighbours and his wife and that still had no idea?
Still have no idea.
Oh. How was your day? Yeah, fine.
Yeah, yeah. Oof. Business as usual.
Yeah.
As a result of his insistence that he was conducting his duties with as much humanity as is possible given the circumstances, he reported that his job didn't leave him feeling any distress or guilt whatsoever, stating that, when I spring the trap, my mind is relaxed, and I have the feeling that I am 10 years younger.
Hmm.
So he's getting something out of it. It's therapeutic for him, even,
yeah.
At this point.
Maybe it's just seeing how all the mechanics work.
Mm, oh, the satisfaction of it all working perfectly. He hears that little snap of the neck and he's like, yes.
You're like, yep, did it.
Another perfect score.
Well done, me. Well done, chap.
Mm. And for the first 6 years of his career, Arthur continued with his impeccable process of execution, nearing 100 to 150 successful jobs.
Okay.
In 1915... Ellis set a new record for the speed of a hanging when he executed a man called Dutch Wagner in just 47 seconds.
Hmm.
Arthur continued to improve his speed, with his highlight being an execution reportedly taking only 15 seconds from entering the condemned cell to pulling the lever for the trapdoor.
March! I need to be in the Guinness World Book of Records.
Well, he reckoned again it was one of those things where it was more humane for the prisoner the shorter time because they didn't have time to process it. It was like...
Yeah, it's just like, get it done.
And then,
done.
Yeah, you've gone. So there's...
Yeah, that must be the worst bit, walking from...
The condemned
cell to the thing.
Well, he made sure, didn't he, towards the later years, that the actual execution site was directly behind the door of the condemned cell. So you had to... It was a matter of steps...
Yeah.
And then you were already on the trapdoor and it was whoop, whoop, boom.
Done.
And we're away. 15 seconds. I don't think it's the quickest. I believe Pierpont was quicker.
Is that the French dude?
No, the Pierpoints were the last sort of dynasty of English
execution. Did we do this?
We've not covered them specifically, but we have talked about them. I believe they got quicker than 15 seconds, but at the time, it was the fastest.
That's pretty quick.
Hangings did not always go smoothly. Such as the incident with a man called Antonius Sprakage. On this occasion, the presiding doctor declared that Sprakage's heart had only stopped beating after 8 minutes.
Jesus.
However, the body continued to twitch, and Sprakage was not declared officially dead for an hour and 11 minutes
after
the hanging had started.
Brutal.
This incident was hushed up by the prison in order to spare Arthur any blushes. As technically, he had successfully hanged the criminal as requested.
Yeah, it just took a while.
Just a little bit longer. He'd been hung by the neck until dead. You know, by the letter of the sentence, he had done it. But you can imagine he probably felt bad about that one. Mm. I tried to cause as little suffering as possible.
And I caused all the suffering.
Yeah, he's just on the train on the way back going, an hour and 11 minutes. God.
Shame on you.
But it was his personal rather than his professional life that was the thing that ended up causing Arthur any level of stress in his new Canadian life.
Go on.
In 1922, his wife, finally tired of his frequent and only vaguely explained trips away. We don't know exactly how, but it's likely that she followed him on one of his trips, probably assuming that he was indulging in some vice or other.
Yeah.
You know, where's he going?
He's got a second family or something.
Yeah. She saw him entering a prison on the day that her hanging was taking place.
She knew.
Mm. She may have done some extra detective work and gone, do you know what? All of his trips seem to coincide with hangings. And he's always, oh no.
He's the hangman.
Yeah. Either way.
I have laid with him.
I've laid with the hangman on many a night. Although they didn't have any children.
That doesn't mean they weren't.
Yeah, no, that's true.
At their business.
Is that how we describe it?
Yeah.
At your business.
Yeah.
She confronted him about his double life. And when Arthur admitted the truth, she left him.
So, I mean, I'm saying, oh, I mean, I would be pretty annoyed as well.
Well, it's a lie of omission, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah.
Although, like you said, you know, he'd never given that information up. From the moment she'd met him, he'd always been this vague.
She probably thought he was doing some government business. Mm.
Well,
not,
he is.
He was hanging... Well, I guess so, yeah.
He just didn't specify what the government business was.
Just murdering loads of people?
No, executing.
Sorry.
He's got a slip from the state to say he's allowed to.
Yeah.
He's got a note. The impact of this loss was profound for Arthur. Without the ability to so neatly compartmentalise his life, he began seeking solace in other places. So it's almost like it forced him to put on the, you know, Arthur the gentleman mask when he went home, because he had his wife to do it for.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had all of these friends and associates and things that he did with his wife, and it kind of, you know, when he wasn't executing, he wasn't an executioner.
Yeah.
Because he had a different name. He went from being Arthur Ellis, the executioner, to Arthur English, the English gentleman who everybody liked. But without the reason to do that as much, because he wasn't putting on appearances for his wife, he began looking for other ways of taking the edge off what he was doing.
Yeah.
And by this, I mean that he began drinking heavily after each execution he completed. So rather than going straight home, he would rent a hotel for the night after the execution and just drink himself into a stupor.
Oh, goodness. So that was keeping him sane, being married?
Being married and having to be Arthur English was keeping him sane, but when he had no reason to go back to being Arthur English, because even when he went home and he was in the house, he was on his own.
Yeah, know that feeling.
He was left as Arthur Ellis for longer and longer periods of time. And that was a difficult person to be.
Oh, I see.
It took a while, but eventually the impact of alcoholism began to show in his work.
Getting sloppy.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a few examples. You can tell me if he's sloppy.
Yeah.
On August 25th, 1926, he was due to execute a man called Daniel Prosiev, who had been convicted of murdering his wife.
Okay.
On this occasion, Arthur miscalculated the length of drop needed. And when Prosiev fell through the trap door, the force of the sudden stop tore his head clean off his shoulders.
Oh, God.
Accidental decapitation.
I mean, that, again, by the letter, that's done the job.
Well, has it, though? Because it's to be hung by the neck until dead. He was only, I mean, if you're being kind, he was only very briefly hung by the neck.
Yeah.
For like a split second.
Oh, God.
Then there was no neck anymore.
Because that must have been some drop if that rips that off.
Mm.
Oh.
It's not great, is it?
No.
Mortified that his professional reputation might be called into question, Arthur forfeited his pay for the job and actually tried to reconcile with Edith.
Okay.
So he saw that he was spiralling. It's like the only thing Edith...
That kept, yeah.
She did come back for a short period of time, but it was less than a year.
Mm.
as he was unable to give up drinking as a means of coping with the sheer volume of executions he was being asked to undertake.
Something snapped, doesn't it?
Yeah, once he started using that as a coping mechanism, Edith came back, but he was still spending the evenings after the executions on his own in a hotel room drinking.
Yeah.
And she could see, like, well...
What are you doing?
Something has changed. We can't go back to the way things were because you're not able to go back to the way things were, so I'm just going to go again.
Yeah.
When I say the amount of executions he was being asked to undertake, it included a number of occasions when he was being expected to execute multiple people at the same time.
Okay.
On one particular occasion, he was asked to execute four men called Frank, Morel, Serfini, and Valentino.
Are they Italian?
I imagine that Serfini and Valentino were from some kind of Latin country. They had murdered a bank messenger during a robbery gone wrong.
Okay.
Due to the prison only having one condemned cell, the decision was taken to have all four men in the yard at the same time, with them being escorted up to the gallows one by one for execution.
Oh, God, that's even worse. Can you imagine being the last person?
Oh, yeah. Because it added time to proceedings, as between each hanging, Arthur had to adjust the length of the rope to take into account the differing weights.
Oh, God.
So it wasn't like, you know, in France when the terror was on and they were taking them up to the guillotine.
Yeah, yeah.
It was quite mechanical, because it didn't really matter who you were. You just slid the head in, slice, mm-hmm. next one.
But the guillotine's the best one, I think.
But with this, it's, oh, well, I've worked out what you each weigh, so I can hang one of you. But then we're going to have to get that guy down, and I'm going to have to set another rope up, and I'm going to have to make sure the length's right, and I'm going to have to do everything that I need to do.
If you and I committed a crime together and were executed that way, because there's a significant difference in our height and weight.
Well, yeah, if they took my weight and my height, you'd probably end up being strangled slowly. And if they took your weight and your height, I'd be popped off.
Decapitated.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a small kindness, but it's nice that he was at least trying to be professional through this, because he could technically have just done a short drop for each of them and just strangled them to death. Frank was executed first without an issue. There was a slight delay, and then Morel was similarly effectively killed via a broken neck. Okay. However, for Serafini and Valentino, having to watch the process proved to be very distressing.
Yes.
In fact, when the next man, we don't know which of the two it was being led up to the platform, he appeared to faint. Arthur knelt down and checked his pulse and stated that he appeared to have died of heart failure.
Okay.
So you can imagine, if your heart's already quite weak and you are watching your friends struggle and die and knowing that
you're next.
Yeah, it's in a matter of minutes, that's what's going to be happening to you. I can see why a heart that's already predisposed towards that might choose that moment to conk out.
Yeah.
However, despite this, Arthur ordered his assistant to lift the body up so as that the noose could be placed around the dead man's neck.
Okay.
He then pulled the lever for the trapdoor so as that no one could argue that the sentence had not been carried out.
Okay.
So when we're talking about, is he getting a bit sloppy? His decision-making skills are a bit weird because he's now hanging a dead person.
A dead person. He's just making sure.
And the other thing is, whichever one of them wasn't the guy who died has just watched this dapper little Englishman hang his friend's dead body for no reason.
Brutal.
In terms of, you did not want to be the last guy to be hung on that day. Nah. Frank had it right. It's just like, it's already set up for me. I can be up and gone in less than a minute. And I'm off. But the rest of you, geez, that's a bad morning for everyone involved.
No one goes away from that feeling good.
Over the course of this second career as a hangman, Arthur is thought to have executed well over 500 people, if not 600. Starting at 48, he worked through his 50s and his 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's a testament to the fact that no one else wanted the job, that even at the age of 71, Arthur was still the man who got the call when someone needed to be unalived by the state.
What year are we in now?
This is 1935.
Jesus.
So he's been doing this since 1912. you know, almost as long as his military career.
Yeah, yeah.
He's been doing the hanging, and he's now a 71-year-old man who's been spiraling for a while, you know, nearly a decade of he's just getting by. Apparently, there was once an occasion where he just started firing a pistol in a theatre at the lights.
And they're too bright.
He was sort of manhandled out. But when they were talking about arresting and convicting him, they were like, well, actually,
he's the executioner.
He's the executioner. We do need to keep him around.
Jesus.
So let's just let him off with a warning for firing a pistol in a theatre.
Jesus.
Just normal behaviour for a hangman. We've got to give him a little bit more leeway than most people. But yeah, he was definitely, you know, struggling at this point.
Unhinged, yeah.
If not unhinged, unhinging.
Yes.
The hinges were no longer as tight as once they were. So, on March 25th, 1935, when a triple hanging was scheduled for Bordeaux jail, Arthur left his home early and made his way to the prison. He was to execute two hitmen and a woman called Thomasina Teolis, who had hired them to kill her husband for the inheritance and insurance money. And they had, you know, husband was dead.
Yeah.
But I think they quickly figured out that, you know,
it
when
was an insurance job.
Yeah, when Thomasina turned up to the insurance company the next day, smiling from ear to ear and cackling maniacally, they were like, oh, I don't know that this was all above board.
Dodgy.
Yeah. Arthur hung the two men simultaneously back to back, which is an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah.
I don't want our butts touching.
Hold my hand. No!
Even though they were pinioned, they could just about pinky to pinky.
Yeah.
Then he prepared the rope for Thomasina. People witnessing the execution reported afterwards that Arthur's hands appeared to shake and that he seemed more clumsy than usual, which they put down to him being distracted, but which I would suggest is likely to happen when you ask a 71-year-old man to work outside in the early morning cold of a March day in Canada. Yeah. He's 71.
I'm old. God damn it.
And this is 1930s 71. Yeah. You know, after a hard life of being a soldier and a hangman. This is not...
He was a Victorian, don't you know?
Well, yeah, goddamn. He was born a Victorian, definitely. Yeah. Eventually, he got the noose set, stepped back, clicked his heels, and released the trapdoor. Thomasina dropped and had her head torn from her neck.
Oh.
The head reportedly bounced and rolled across the prison yard, much to the horror of the onlookers.
Yeah, but...
Because I don't know, some of them, you know, that the pit underneath where you dropped into was kind of like contained. I'm wondering if the one at Bordeaux jail was
just
not...
Just went straight.
And was just open on the side so that you could see the full thing. In which case, yes, I'm sure that head could roll quite away.
Gross.
Mm. This gruesome spectacle having occurred to a woman horrified Canadians when it was reported in the newspapers. The prison authorities were happy for Arthur to take all the blame for the incident. However, Arthur claimed that due to having to execute three people at once, he had not been allowed to weigh and measure Thomasina beforehand, and had been told that this had been done on his behalf, when in actuality, the prison warden had just given him her weight at the point of entering the prison, which was substantially lighter than on the day of her execution.
How's that? Was they fattening her up then?
I don't think it's so much fattening her up as you're sentenced to death and you're obviously going through the process of all the appeals that people go through.
Yeah.
You know, we're in the 1930s now, so there's this process. You'll be there for a while. And what else have you got to do? You're in a small cell. You're not allowed to go anywhere. You're not really allowed to exercise, but they're bringing you three square meals a day.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair enough.
You know, so she was a bit more tubby. But they gave Arthur the weight that she was when she got there. They said there was something like £30 difference in it, which apparently is enough for, you know, the head to be ripped from the shoulders.
£30, that's quite a lot.
It's something you want to know about as an executioner.
Yeah.
Definitely. Regardless of if Arthur was telling the truth, the execution of Thomasina was the last one he completed.
I mean, he'd done quite a few, so... Mm. I mean, and what a way to go.
Yeah. For your last one.
Yeah. Ta-da.
Despite making significant amounts during his tenure as chief executioner, it seemed that he spent the money just as fast as he made it, meaning that the loss of his job quickly pushed him towards poverty.
Oh, wow.
Arthur was able to find a job in a local department store. However, this proved to be brief, because as soon as the customers found out about his former occupation, they made it clear that they did not feel comfortable being served by an executioner.
Mm-hmm.
So he was...
that's that tarnished reputation.
Yeah, and not just that.
But he comes from money, doesn't he, surely?
He came from a well-to-do background, but
okay,
he'd obviously been burning through that cash. Yeah. And I wonder if, because he was getting paid so well and he was doing so many executions, because we're talking about a career of 25 years and he did over 500. Yeah. So that's he was making a heck of a lot of money per year. But if you're used to having that income, you might be spending.
Spend it, yeah.
Either way, he didn't have any left. And when he tried to get other jobs, it was always the same thing of, well, first of all, you're in your 70s.
Yeah.
Secondly, you're an executioner. And thirdly, the reason you lost your job, we all know because it was a public scandal, was because you had someone's head pop off like a champagne cork. So we don't need that publicity.
That poor lady.
Yeah. It was terrible for her. It was terrible for Arthur. No one won in that situation.
No.
Arthur ended up in a boarding house, barely surviving via loans from his few remaining friends. He was discovered in his small room, practically starved to death, in July of 1938, and rushed to the local hospital. His long-suffering ex-wife, Edith, came to visit him and to make peace. However, there was nothing that the doctors could do, and Arthur English, the most prolific executioner in Canadian history, died on July 21st, 1938.
Oh, at least he didn't witness World War Two.
I mean, you're really clutching at straws there. But yeah, he didn't witness the beginning of World War II.
No.
And it was good that Edith made amends with him, because she actually saved him from having a pauper's grave. And he was instead buried at the Mount Royal Cemetery. So she did that for him as a kindness.
Oh, okay.
Arthur's name did live on via the Crime Writers of Canada Awards of Excellence, which were known as the Arthur Ellis Awards. And apparently if you won one, the statuette you got was a little wooden statue of a hanging man. And there was a little rope attached, and if you pulled it, the man would jerk.
No way.
Yeah. If you search for an Arthur Ellis Award, you can see an example.
Does that still exist?
The awards still exist. However, they dropped the name Arthur Ellis in 2021.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which seems a big shame to me. I mean, why wouldn't you celebrate this man?
What do you think it's to do with what he did?
Well, everyone knew what he'd done. I think it was a tongue-in-cheek joke. Yeah. But,
oh, God, I've just Googled the thing.
Have you seen the little statuette?
Oh, my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's a fun... I mean, I guess it's in bad taste, but we're, you know, nearly 100 years on.
I want one. Mm. Do you reckon they've got them in eBay?
Probably not. I think the people who won them would probably be quite proud of them.
Yeah, but there must be, like, knock-ups. Knock-ups? Knock-offs?
You can knock one up yourself. I mean, the pictures I saw, you could pretty much see all of the mechanism. It wasn't like it was a secret.
No, you're right.
And the source that I used, the source that originally made me want to write it, was that very sensationalist article that I referenced. It was from the San Francisco Examiner, their issue on September the 18th, 1938. But obviously, you know, as soon as I realised that a few of the things couldn't possibly have happened, I had to pretty much fact check it all, which is fine.
Yeah,
I mean, they were wanting to sell newspapers. That was their thing.
I mean, regardless of what was tall tales and what wasn't, I think that was an excellent story.
Mm.
I also want to see a picture of Arthur Ellis.
They do exist. Yeah, Arthur Ellis pictures do exist. He was
Canada's hangman. Oh, there he is.
There you go. With his little moustache.
Oh, so this is when he's older, by the looks of things. He's not got his moustache there.
Oh, did they take some pictures like that? There's definitely a picture I saw. His funeral was not well attended.
Okay. Arthur B. English.
Yeah, Bartholomew.
Mm. So that's interesting.
There you go. There was only one official hangman after Arthur, before the death penalty was completely
taken away. Which year was that, do we know, in Canada?
It was in, I think it was 62, was the last execution that took place.
Was that around the same year as it was here?
Yeah, 60 seemed to be a good decade for, you know, getting rid of the death penalty.
Because wasn't someone called Ruth Ellis one of the last people to be hanged in hanged? Is that the right word?
No, it is hanged. You're not supposed to say hung.
In the UK.
Convicted murderer, the last woman to be executed.
Oh, good, I'm good.
Yeah, blooming egg. So apparently the name Ellis and hanging is just the two go together.
So let's see.
So nicely.
When was the last hanging in the UK? 1964.
Yeah. All around the same time. August, it wasn't officially taken off the statutes in most places until like the 90s, but it was just that, you know, they just didn't do it anymore.
Yeah. Interesting. That's mad. Like, my mum and dad were alive.
Yeah, yeah. My dad would have been.
Mm. Madness.
Hi there, it's Emma, Chief Organiser at Consistently Eccentric. Here to remind you all that if you like what you hear, you can catch up with all previous episodes and session series by searching for us on Acast, Spotify and iTunes. How fancy. You can also join us on Instagram at Consistently Eccentric Podcast, where we update on the weekly episode and post all of our bonus content for you lucky lot. See you next week.